Okay, what we're going to do today is we're going to finish off the creation Psalms and then move into the creation text in the book of Proverbs, and especially looking at Proverbs 3 and Proverbs chapter 8.
I don't want you nuts.
Chapter 8 in Proverbs is where you've got the third of the creation texts that take you through the six creation days. You've heard me say this before, whenever you're looking at Genesis 1, you also want to look at the parallel accounts in Job 37 through 39, Psalm 104, and Proverbs 8. And so we'll be checking out what Proverbs 8 has got to say and how that allows us to build a consistent creation text of what's happening throughout the history of life here on planet Earth. Now, what we've been doing in Psalm 147 and 48, we started off with the stars, and we're ending up with the precipitation patterns, the plants, and finally the ice. And last week we tried to finish up our talk on the ice ages and why we need them and why we have such a blessed ice age right now. And let me put this up here for you. And then we're going to talk a little bit about minerals as we finish off this study. But this is the Vostok ice core drill in Antarctica, showing the last 800,000 years of climate, and they're now ready to release 1 million years worth. The last 200,000 layers are the most difficult layers to analyze. Why? Because you got the weight of all the layers above crushing the layers at the bottom, so the layers at the bottom are very, very thin and are much more challenging to analyze, but they're about to release that data any time now. But this shows the last 800,000 years. And most of the curves you see there are looking at isotopes, and you put the isotopes together, you get the temperature. And the red line, which is the second line from the top, shows the temperature of the last few ice ages. I think that one shows you the last four ice ages. But the pattern you see there is that the temperature of the planet spikes up to about 3 degrees centigrade or 5 degrees Fahrenheit above where it is right now. And when it hits that maximum, you get a sudden drop in temperature, which brings about an ice age. And the ice age typically lasts for about 90,000 years. Then the ice age comes to an end, and the temperature spikes back up again. And notice that that spike period where you get relatively warm temperatures, where you don't have most of North America and Asia glaciated over, it typically lasts less than 10,000 years. Yes?
Does the temperature rise when it gets to that top point, does that cause the next ice age, or is that and the ice age caused by a thing, by some third, fourth, or fifth thing?
Well, it's something that scientists would love to know. As I mentioned last week, climatology is about where weather forecasting was 100 years ago. So we don't have really good climatology models. In fact, these core drills, both in Antarctica, and Greenland, one of the missions of those ice core drills was to try to develop much better climate models. And so we're... In fact, the next chart I'm going to show you is the latest and best ice core drill. And so, but the feeling is that there's something that happens when the temperature of the planet hits a peak that causes the temperature to dramatically drop. And the one viable model I'm aware of is where the temperature goes up, it melts the polar ice cap. And when you melt the polar ice cap, sunlight falls upon the water, evaporates a lot more water, because ice reflects very well, a lot water, more than liquid water does. The reflectivity of liquid water is a good factor, 3 or 4 less than it is on frozen ice. And so it means that the Arctic waters will absorb more solar heat, evaporates more water, and that causes more precipitation to fall upon Canada and upon Siberia. Keep in mind those big, thick forests that blanket all of northern Canada and all of Siberia, those forests are sustained by just 10 inches of precipitation a year. If it wasn't for the fact that those places were so cold, they'd be barren deserts. But because they're so cold, that little bit of precipitation is enough to sustain these vast forests that cover Canada and Northern Europe, virtually all of Siberia and, you know, Sweden, Norway, Finland are all covered with these forests that get very little precipitation. If you double the precipitation, which is what a lot of people think will happen when you melt the polar ice cap, then very quickly you get ice accumulating on those land areas, accumulating literally to thousands of feet thick. And the last ice age, the ice went all the way down into mid-California. Yosemite was covered with glaciers. So, by the way, the last ice age was considered to be one of the more severe ice ages that we've experienced in the last several million years. Typically, it doesn't get all the way down to, you know, the mid part of California. But the last one did. In fact, almost half of the 48 states was covered in ice, or at least a third of it was covered in ice. So this shows the last ice age. This is the Neem drill in Antarctica. This is the most recent drill. By the way, let me just stop here for a minute, because a lot of you asked me to please report on the discovery of the dinosaur they found in Patagonia. It's the largest land animal ever discovered. They believe it weighed a minimum of 77 tons. To give you some idea, its height was 70 feet above the ground and its length was 120 feet. The record dinosaur they had found previously, land dinosaur, was 100 feet long. This thing is at least 120 feet long, and it's also the tallest of the dinosaurs, coming in at 70 feet. Discovered in southern Argentina by a farmer, is plowing up his field and found a bone that was about twice the size of a man. Turned out to be the leg bone of the dinosaur. It's actually bigger around than a man is, and about half again as tall as a 6 foot tall man. So it's the biggest bone ever discovered. And
it's a plant eater?
It would have been a plant eater, yes. A carnivore couldn't exist at that size, but a plant eater can. And also, this is almost at the limit of what the laws of physics will permit for the size of an animal. So, in fact, this creature is so big and so heavy, it would have had to have spent its entire lifetime walking around in a shallow sea. The sea would have to come up to about 30 feet just to be able to support this kind of body mass. So a creature like that could not exist on planet Earth today. But back in the era of the dinosaurs, a good chunk of China, North America, and South America was covered in shallow lakes and seas, basically seas that were anywhere from 10 to 40 feet deep. And evidently what was existing there in Argentina was a big shallow sea, 20, 30, 40, 50 feet deep, that this dinosaur could wander around in, and with his long neck pick up vegetation on the floor of the big lake or sea, or with the bushes and trees that were growing in that area. But without the water, it wouldn't be able to support its body mass. And so today, you look at elephants, that's right about at the top of what you can have in terms of mass for a creature without the support of water to keep its body mass up. Now, the biggest animal that ever existed is actually on the planet today. The blue whale is the biggest animal that we've ever seen in the entire fossil record. But it exists in the ocean. And because it spends its entire time in the ocean, it's able to sustain a body mass that big. How big is the biggest blue whale? 200 tons. So it comes in a little bit bigger than this dinosaur. But that's an animal that's completely supported by water. So you need the buoyancy of the water in order to sustain that body mass. But how it fits into a creation model is what you see in Psalm 104, how God packs the planet with as much life as possible, as diverse as possible, and as long as possible. And there's one era in the past history of the Earth where you got these very large, extensive, shallow seas and lakes. And that's the era where you got the dinosaurs. It's the only time you got dinosaurs on the face of the Earth. It's the only time that you've got geographical conditions that would actually support creatures that are that size. But it's making the point that God takes advantage of whatever habitat there is to fill those habitats with as abundant life as possible and as diverse as possible. So he's literally making animals as big as you can possibly make. And that's what we see in the face of the earth today. Given the habitats we have animals as big as the laws of physics will permit and as small as the laws of physics will permit. And so it really kind of shows the desire of the Creator really to pack our planet with as much living organisms and diversity of organisms as possible. But hey, if you want to read about it, it's all over the web. You can go online this afternoon. It's generating a lot of excitement. And the farmer basically has been told, we're going to be digging up your field for the next 2 years. So, but they're going to be paying him quite well for the privilege to dig up his field, because they actually feel that there's probably going to be several dozen dinosaur fossils they'll be able to pull out of that particular farmer's field. Yeah, question over here.
Is it a known species of dinosaur?
No, it's a brand new species of dinosaur, and there's a lot of speculation what they're going to call this dinosaur, and the name that's in the running is Super Patagonia Saurus. So we'll see. They usually name it after the locale in which it is found, but personally I think they're going to try to come up with a shorter name, but that's the one that's been suggested so far.
Titanosaurus.
What'd be another one?
I heard one newscaster call it Shackersaurus.
All right. That's what happens when the scientists don't give it a name right away. People just go...
They need to team up with some L.A. rappers, you know.
There you go. All right. Well, back to this Ice Age thing here. So I mentioned last week, what we're seeing in this particular Ice Age is an extreme anomaly. Where instead of the temperature, well, you do see the temperature spike if, and by the way, this is typical, the temperature spikes when the ice age is most severe. So here you're at the very bottom of the ice age, and you see that in the previous ice age cycles as well. If I can flip this back here for you. You'll notice that consistently the temperature spikes when you get the greatest or the coldest temperatures and the greatest glaciation. So when you got thousands of feet of ice packing down in Canada and Siberia and other parts of the world, that's when the temperature begins to spike up. And a lot of people think it's because the weight of the ice actually starts to release greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, and that begins to warm things up. And also, this is when you've got the cycle of the Earth's orbit returning into what they call a warm forcing era. So I mentioned last week, the primary thing driving these ice ages are variations in Earth's orbit. You know, our planet is orbiting about the sun. By the way, I read a poll recently where it said that 42% of Americans actually think that the sun is going around the Earth rather than the Earth going around the sun. So... if that doesn't tell you we need a little more physics education in the public school system, I don't know what does. So, but I can tell you as an astronomer, the Earth really does revolve around the sun. Or to be more specific, the Earth and the sun revolve around what's called the center of mass. So the sun actually does do a revolution, but it's revolving around the center of mass of the solar system. And so the sun orbits a very tiny distance, the Earth a large distance. But as it orbits about the sun, the shape of the orbit will change from year to year. As I mentioned last week, the elliptical nature of the orbit varies over a cycle of about 100,000 years. Actually, there's several cycles. There's a 2.8 million year cycle, a 4 million year cycle, and a 100,000 year cycle. And then the tilt of the orbit relative to the plane of the solar system also varies a little bit. That's called the obliquity. So there's a slight difference in the tilt of the orbit of the Earth. And that has an impact on the climate. And the third thing that influences the climate is what's called the precession. And this is where you've got the spinning Earth. And just like a rapidly spinning top, it goes through a very slow precession cycle of 26,000 years. So right now the variation in the tilt of the orbit is 41,000 years. The variation in the eccentricity of the orbit is 100,000 years. And the variation in the precession is 26,000 years. But right now, the 100,000-year cycle is dominant. By the way, that wasn't always the case. There was a time we got ice ages every 41,000 years instead of every 100,000 years. Turns out 100,000-year ice age cycles are ideal for sustaining global agriculture. I'll talk about that in a minute. Why you need to thank God for ice ages when you celebrate Thanksgiving. If we don't have ice ages, you can't grow the abundance of crops, and the crops won't be as nutritious as they are in order to sustain you. So, and this is what's amazing, is astronomers are recognizing we're probably looking at the only planet that has these cyclical ice ages that actually work to bring about the concentration of nutrients into agricultural areas. Yes? It does over the period of billions of years. But, what you're getting with the uranium and thorium in the interior of the Earth, it provides a heat flow. And, yeah, we get a little bit of heat from that uranium and thorium, but right now it's just the tiniest fraction of the heat that we get from the sun. So the heat we get from the sun completely dominates the climate. But that wasn't always the case. You go back, say, 4 billion years ago, the heat flow from the interior was a significant fraction. Okay. Where was I on these ice ages? Yes. So when it hits this minimum, notice that you get a sharp kick up, and this is because now the shape of the orbit is such that it's causing less snow to accumulate and warmer summers to take place, and then the temperature spikes up. And as I mentioned last week, we have an especially benign situation because we're at that point in the orbit of the rotation of the Earth where the northern hemisphere is closest to the sun in the wintertime and farthest away from the sun in the summertime. And the impact of that is that we who live in the northern hemisphere have cooler summers and warmer winters. And we were talking last week, what is responsible for what they call this long summer? Or better, would be referred to it as the long spring. Because what we've had here is 9,000 years of relatively steady temperature. The temperature hasn't varied by more than half a degree centigrade over the last 9,000 years. And it's just at 3 degrees below the maximum. And the feeling is that if you punch up to that maximum, you're going to, again, get a catastrophic cooling and bring about the next ice age. But one of the studies that I've been reading is that the fact that we are in that period of the precession of the Earth's orbit, where we're closer to the sun in the wintertime and farther away in the summertime, is at least in part responsible for the fact that we've had this, quote, long summer. But I think you can all understand that that's the temperature that's ideal for spreading global civilization, and it's literally been sustained for the last 9,000 years. And, of course, the goal of people is, can we extend it much longer? And there's a lot of concern that looks like that's not going to happen. The temperature is now starting to rise significantly. So, but as you can see, that did not happen in the last ice age. In fact, as we go back in time over the last 40 ice ages, it's never happened. This is the only time that we've had an ice age where we've had this long summer lasting thousands of years. And by the way, there's been previous ice ages where just like now, you had this ideal precession where you get the warmest, you get the closest proximity to the sun in the wintertime and the farthest in the summertime. So that alone cannot explain that long summer. It's still considered to be an unanswered issue. Why do we have this long summer? Why didn't it happen before? Why is it only happening now? A lot of people think that human activity is a factor, but we don't know exactly how human activity is a factor. What we do know is that human activity has delayed the onset of the ice age. We're roughly 5,000 years overdue for an ice age. And so human activity, mainly the domestication of animals, has sustained the warming of the planet long enough that we don't have an ice age. But again, climatologists are telling us that we need to not warm it too much, because evidently, if we get it much warmer, we're going to bring on an ice age, because that's what's happened every time. Once the temperature hits 3 degrees centigrade above where we are now, every single time, that's brought about an ice age. And the melting of the polar ice cap is one scenario. Another scenario is the shutting down of the Gulf Stream. Maybe there's something that happens when the climate of the planet warms that leads to the shutting down of the Gulf Stream, and if that were to happen, that will bring colder conditions into northern Europe and eastern Canada. And it may be a combination of those two. There may be other factors involved as well. You know, as I talked to my climatologist friends, so like, how much time are you going to need and research funding are you going to need to be able to figure out why we've had this long summer? And they said, well, give us a few hundred years and we should have the data to be able to tell you. But the concern is within a few hundred years, we may already have a temperature spike that brings about the next ice age. So there's genuine concern. We're not going to find out in time in order to maintain that condition much longer. From a Christian perspective, I'd say maybe it's to our advantage to fulfill the Great Commission quickly. Then we don't have to worry about those 300 years or 400 years we need to figure out this problem. But yeah, it is a huge scientific issue. Supercomputers are only part of the problem. We need better computers, but we also need a lot more data. And we really need to have hundreds of... I mean, after all, you're trying to figure out something that takes about 100,000 years to cycle through. And if all you got is 100 or 150 years of data, that's just not enough to be able to build any kind of decent climatology model. And so it will take more time before we figure this all out. But let me segue from that issue. And again, I'm not saying that, you know, the melting of the polar ice cap is going to bring it about, or the shutting down of the Gulf Stream. It may be a combination of those two and many other factors as well. But one thing that we've learned to appreciate about the ice ages is that what it does for the development of minerals and nutrients. And so we really do need these ice ages. And there's a couple of research papers that have been published making the point that we live on the most mineral-rich body in the entire universe. Now, let me just kind of take you through the history of the buildup of minerals and where ice ages fit in to the building up of these minerals. And by the way, it's not just the buildup of certain minerals. Ice ages fulfill a role in moving the minerals and the nutrients into a place where we human beings can exploit them. I mean, for example, if you've got a lot of gold underground, it's not going to do Stone Age people a lot of good if that gold isn't somehow brought up to the surface where they can find it and discover it. Ice actually helps in that factor. But when our planetary system was forming, we began with just 12 minerals. Can you believe that? Here we have this giant gas cloud condensing to form our sun and the protoplanets that are orbiting about our sun, but it all starts off with just 12 minerals. That's it, just 12 minerals. In the giant molecular clouds. Now, we have primitive meteorites from which the Earth and the rocky planets form. They have 60 minerals. And we now have a good understanding how it is that these meteorites that are the building blocks of the rocky planets, the planets that form the inner part of our solar system, namely Mars, Earth, Venus, and Mercury, that they form from building blocks that it's 60 minerals. How did they get those 60 minerals? Well, we have our solar system being formed relatively close to the center of our galaxy. I should actually show you a chart here. I don't have it right here with me. But we actually have a fairly good idea where our planetary system formed. Roughly about 20% of the way out from the center of our galaxy. Not right at the center, but just a little bit beyond the center. And that's an area where you have these giant molecular clouds that form star clusters with 10,000 plus members. And so we now recognize that our sun formed in a giant cluster with more than 10,000 stars in it. The stars were relatively close together, close enough together that our sun was exposed to at least four different kinds of supernova eruptions. each of those supernovae produced different elements. And then these elements got incorporated into this molecular cloud, and that began to generate minerals. Now, you need what are called asymptotic giant branch stars. You need a certain category of white dwarf binaries and four different kinds of supernova, supernova as well. All of those are responsible for a planet being enriched with the 98 elements that you have. Remember, we went to high school, they told you it was 92 elements. 92 elements make up the periodic table. Well, we live on one of the very few planets that will probably have all 92 of those elements. Most planets that we see in our galaxy are going to have a few dozen of those elements or less. But we live in a planet where we got the whole lot. We have the whole lot because certain of those elements are made by type 2 supernova, others are made by type 1a, you got type 1b supernova. Different supernova make different kinds of heavy elements. And our sun had the good fortune of forming right next to these exploding stars of all different characters. And so the cloud in which the sun and the planets were born was super enriched with all these elements from these different kinds of supernova. Fluorine, for example, is not made by supernova, but it's made by red giant stars when they end their burning cycle. But you need a really big red giant star because the smaller ones will take too long to emit their fluorine. But we happen to be next to a nice young giant one that gave us a good enrichment of the fluorine. The other thing that's important is to be near what are called Wolf Riot stars. These are giant blue-white stars, and they will blast our planetary system with a lot of aluminum-26. You say, what's aluminum-26? Well, aluminum-27 is what you make your pots and pans out of. Aluminum-26 is radioactive aluminum, but it has a half-life of about 500,000 years. So there's none of it around anymore. But our nascent solar system was saturated with this aluminum-26. And what it did is it drove off a lot of the light elements. So, for example, our planet is under-endowed in hydrogen and carbon and nitrogen. We don't have a lot of those elements. They're the light things, and the aluminum-26 blasted it all away. We're now finding planets that are Earth-like. These Earth-like planets are coming in with about 1,000 times as much carbon as our planet has, and 2,000 times as much nitrogen. And that much carbon and nitrogen means there'd be no possibility of having an atmosphere that could sustain advanced life. So it's important to blast away the light stuff and keep the heavy stuff. And that's kind of what happened with our Earth. Now, how did the Earth form? It formed from these primitive meteorites that had incorporated all these elements, the 92 elements, and then the elements began to combine and to make minerals. In fact, the primitive meteorites are dominated by what are called polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. You say, what are those? Well, come Memorial Day, you'll probably do a barbecue, and when you finish with your barbecue, there'll be all this black tarry stuff on the grill, and you kind of scrape that off, and if you ever have done that, it's very, very sticky. Well, what you have in the nascent solar system, you got the sun forming, and then you got this big cloud of debris around the sun, but it's dominated by these small bodies, and I'm talking bodies about the size of the tip of my thumb, that have a lot of the sticky stuff in it. And therefore, when they bump into one another, they stick together, and they begin to accumulate and grow. And that's basically how we got our planet. Thanks to the polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, instead of these particles colliding with one another and bouncing off, they collide and stick and coagulate. And so, but in those polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons are about these 60 minerals. Okay, now as they stick together, you get what's called an achondritic formation, which actually causes 250 minerals to build up. So, when our planet was fully formed by all these meteorites, thanks to the sticky stuff, thanks to the water, and thanks to the sunlight, that drove reactions that built everything up to 250 minerals. Now, that 250 is a very large figure. most planets are not going to have anywhere near those 250 when they get started. But that's how our planet began, with 250 minerals. Now, most planets, if you go to Venus and Mars, for example, they still have those 250. So one of the problems of trying to get life going on Mars, I mean, we could send a bunch of colonists to Mars. By the way, I think they've got 2,000 people already signed up saying that they'll go on a one-way trip to Mars and try to do what the pilgrims did and get things running. Well, if they get to Mars, they're going to discover there's only 250 minerals there. And that's going to make it rather challenging to develop any kind of a colony, civilized colony there. They're going to have to import the minerals from Earth, which isn't going to be a cheap proposition. So that's what we started off with. But if you actually study the origin of life on planet Earth, we have God creating life on planet Earth 3.83 billion years ago. And we now understand that that life played a critical role in initiating plate tectonics. And so we live on a planet that has plate tectonics, but it takes life to get that plate tectonics really up and running. What happens is the first life is including a photosynthetic life, but it's what we call anoxic photosynthetic life. In other words, it's photosynthetic life that can operate in an atmosphere that has very little or no oxygen. And for example, we now know at the origin of life on planet Earth, the oxygen level in the atmosphere was about 0.001% of what it is right now. Incidentally, that's enough oxygen to stop any naturalistic prebiotic chemistry. Knowledge that much oxygen existed on the Earth is sufficient to tell us that Earth never had a naturalistic prebiotic soup. It takes a creator, a supernatural creator, to develop the building blocks to make that first life. Otherwise, the oxygen would never permit that to take place. But that anoxic oxygenic life, what it does, it produces, when that life dies, it produces a sediment that generates what geologists call black shales. And black shales are where we find the first chemical signatures of life here on planet Earth. But those signatures tell us that even at the beginning of the origin of life on planet Earth, the Earth was filled with these photosynthetic life forms, but not the kind of photosynthetic life we have today. That kind of life cannot exist in a high oxygen environment. You get a lot of oxygen in the atmosphere, it kills those bacteria. By the way, they still exist on the planet today, but they exist at the bottom of oceans where there's very little oxygen. They can survive there, or they can survive underground. So where the oxygen content is low enough, they can still thrive. But what they do is when they die, they produce the sediment that generates these black shales. Now, what's in the black shales? The black shales have the property that they concentrate uranium and thorium. And by the way, there's uranium and thorium all over the crust of the Earth. Those of us who live here in California, we get an extra dose of uranium and thorium. And you can thank the glaciers and the ice and the snow for the fact that we have a little more uranium and thorium in our soil than other parts of the country. Colorado has a fair amount of uranium and thorium in their soil as well. But these anoxic oxygenic photosynthetic life forms have the property that they concentrate uranium and thorium in these shales. Now what that does is it produces a surface heat source, and that surface heat source plays a role in kick-starting the plate tectonics. And once you've got the plate tectonics going, you've got another mechanism for generating minerals. But the mechanism for generating minerals is far more efficient where it's actually combined with life. And so what a number of researchers have pointed out is that life plays a role in altering the geochemical cycles of planet Earth. And so life-initiated tectonics takes that 250 minerals and builds it up to 1,500. So by the time you go back to 3.5 billion years ago, the combination of life and plate tectonics, these unicellular life forms, basically the anoxic photosynthetic life, and the initiation of plate tectonics generates 1,500 minerals. Now, it doesn't happen all at once. Because what's taking place is that life gets tectonics going, but not plate tectonics. And it literally takes about 800 million years of life on planet Earth to get full-blown plate tectonics. So what you have here on planet Earth in the first 800 million years of life, that's 3 billion years ago to 3.8 billion years ago, is that you have life that's becoming more prolific, more abundant, and it's causing the tectonic activity to gradually ramp up. And so it's local. Right now, we've got global tectonics. But at the origin of life, tectonics was limited to just a few areas. And by the way, life is not the only thing you need. You need a few big asteroids and comets smashing into the Earth, because when they smash into the Earth, they puncture the crust, and they cause pieces of crust to build up, and that causes some gravitational stress, which stimulates the plate tectonics, combined with the black shales and the life. I won't go into all the details, but what happens is that plate tectonics gradually ramps up, where it becomes a global phenomena, and the aggressive nature of the tectonics gets greater and greater, and by the time you get through the first 800 million years, you actually got mountain ranges forming. You can't get mountain ranges unless you've got really aggressive, globally sustained plate tectonics. And once you've got the formation of these long mountain chains, that too contributes to the buildup of minerals. Yes?
Are you saying that there was no life on Earth, there would be no plate tectonics at all, or it would be different, or it would have taken longer, or what?
Okay. You can get plate tectonics without life, but what we're now understanding is it shuts down quickly. Venus, for example, had a brief episode of tectonics, but it shut down and never came back on. What we have here on Earth instead is you get tectonics initiated, and it is sustained. So, for example, you can have huge volcanic eruptions, and that will build up the kind of an above-surface landmass, and all around that landmass you're going to get gravitational stresses, which will stimulate the tectonics. But it's a temporary phenomenon. Just likewise, if you get an asteroid smashing at the Earth, it's going to disturb the vertical texture of the crust. So that's going to be a factor. Another factor is that you've got a lot of heat flow from the uranium and thorium in the interior of the Earth. And so we typically see with rocky planets like the Earth, they have a tectonic event very early in their history, but once the heat flow subsides, it shuts down the tectonics. Now, you put life into the equation. What that life does is it actually causes water, because, you know, these life forms pick up water, and then when they get buried, the water gets put into the crust of the Earth, and if you get a bit of tectonics, gets driven into the mantle, so the mantle becomes wetter. When the mantle becomes wetter, the viscosity becomes less. You get a lesser viscosity or a greater viscosity difference between the mantle and the crust, and that will stimulate the tectonics. And so really what's driving the tectonics on Earth today is you have life delivering a lot of water into the subduction zones. And by the way, that delivery of water into the subduction zones causes a chemical reaction which produces talc at the subduction zone. And what that talc does is allows these slabs to slide under one another more easily. So without the life, you're not going to get sufficient talc production. Without sufficient talc production, you're not going to get enough of that slab material flowing under. You won't get enough water delivery into the mantle of the Earth. And by the way, the talc is good for another reason. It makes the earthquakes less shaking. I mean, I don't know what the word is. Severe. Okay.
So.
Okay. As you may have heard, I'm actually writing a book on the history of life on planet Earth. And I found out nobody's really kind of put all this together. So there's actually about 200 papers that have been published where they get snippets of this, but nobody's really kind of put the whole story together. And what we're discovering, at reasons to believe, there's about six factors that must be in play in order to get the tectonics started. And then several other factors are necessary to keep it sustained. But life is crucial. Now, without the plate tectonics, you can't sustain life on planet Earth. The tectonics recycles the nutrients. If you don't recycle the nutrients, you can't sustain life on planet Earth for billions of years. But if you don't have life on planet Earth, you can't sustain the tectonics for billions of years. So it's like a symbiotic relationship. You need the life to keep the tectonics going. You need the tectonics to keep the life going. And they have to work in perfect synergy in order to keep things sustained. So, for example, if life were to get wiped out at a point, that would shut down the whole thing permanently. And then the planet would be sterile from that point onward. And therefore, we're arguing in this book we're working on, you need a creator who knows precisely the physics and the geophysics of the Earth, knowing what life to have on the Earth at what time, how abundant it must be, where that life must be, to sustain the tectonics at such a level that you can keep the life there going for that period of time, and in the process, build up all the minerals that you need. Yes?
Well, so are those, to get to my level here, understanding, are those plates moving down, far down, but you get earthquakes, they're nearer the surface? That's the idea?
Well, to get the efficient delivery of water, you need to have these plates adjoining one another, where you get what's called subduction phenomena, where one plate will slide under the other plate. And when that happens, you get a significant delivery of organic material and water into the mantle of the Earth. And that's crucial to keep the tectonics going. And likewise, as plates slide like that, at the subduction zone, the boundary between the two plates. This is assuming it's underwater. So if you got a, and that's typically what happens, is the plates will slide under one another where you've got a water situation. So for example, off of Japan, you've got plates doing this. Off of North America, you also, like the Juan de Fuca fault, is a place where you've got a slab going under like that. And if the ocean has the right depth and the right temperature, then you'll get talc being formed. But if the depth is wrong or the temperature is wrong, you get no talc. If you get no talc, you won't have as many earthquakes, but when you get them, they're going to be really, really nasty. So instead of just a nice magnitude 8, you're going to get a magnitude 10 or 11.
Ooh, that's a pinch.
Yeah, that is a pinch. You're going to get about a thousand times more shaking, so kind of work that out. So, but yeah, that's one of the nice things. We live in a planet where we have this efficient production of talc, which lubricates the plates, causes them to slide relative to one another, so that, yeah, we might get a magnitude 9 once in a while, several 8s, a bunch of 7s, a whole bunch of 6s, but we're not going to get something that's going to wipe out all of civilization. Okay, over here.
Yeah, what role did the late heavy bombardment have in, like, setting the stage for this? Wouldn't that have brought a lot of minerals, periodic table elements and all, into the Earth and increased the mass somewhat?
Well, the late heavy bombardment would have brought these to the Earth. So basically, it doesn't change anything. What it will do is, make the temperature of the surface of the Earth extremely hot, and so you really can't have abundant life on the planet until the late heavy bombardment is over. But when the late heavy bombardment is over, you're not getting thousands of bombardments over the course of a few hundred thousand years. You're getting a few. But I can tell you, from 3.5 to 3.8 billion years previous to the present, you're still getting occasional very significant bombardments. We're talking asteroids and comets that are 10 to 30 kilometers in diameter. And bombarders that are that big are going to significantly disturb the crust of the Earth. And this is where you're going to get...
Shielding that effectively at that time?
It was. But the problem is you had a lot of bombarding material. Because the late heavy bombardment basically shatters 99% of the Kuiper Belt. And a lot of that stuff gets ejected out of the solar system. A lot of it bombards the inner solar system planets. A lot of it gets picked up by the sun. But there's a residual that keeps bombarding the Earth. Nowhere near the intensity of the late heavy bombardment. Nevertheless, intense enough to generate local crustal disturbances that actually contributes to the generation of plate tectonics. You're not going to get plate tectonics during the late heavy bombardment because it's just too severe. Basically, you're getting no crust at all. And so you got to wait till that's over, and then you get these local disturbances, which will generate local tectonics. And so the local tectonics is a place where life begins to contribute. And basically the role life plays is actually step by step broadening the experience of tectonics where it becomes a global phenomenon. But it takes 800 million years of life on planet Earth to get the tectonics built up to a point where it becomes a global phenomenon. Yes?
Without the Mars-sized collider, we wouldn't have any of the sustained plate tectonics. I mean, that really is the first thing that set up also the sustained plate tectonics.
Yeah, the moon-forming event super enriched the Earth with uranium and thorium. We got a little more enrichment with the late heavy bombardment. But yeah, without all that uranium and thorium, you're not going to be able to sustain plate tectonics for 4 billion years or 3.8 billion years. So yeah, when you celebrate Thanksgiving, you might want to thank God for the moon-forming event that gave us all that uranium and thorium so that we could have the nutrient recycling that's necessary to grow our crops as nutritious as they are over the whole extent of the planet. Yes?
I have a question.
All right, just wait a minute. We got a question here first. Yes?
I'm wondering about the thickness of the plates and their pressure and temperature degrading molecular biology molecules.
Okay. Before life was created, the crust was about the same thickness everywhere on the planet. And, with life on the planet and with these bombardments, we had local variations. And so there'd be parts of the crust that were thicker than other parts. You're going to get that with a bombardment event. And that will generate gravitational stresses, which will encourage the tectonics. And again, you got enough heat flow from the uranium and thorium that our planet was super enriched with that will also stimulate the tectonics. And the life that grows there on those continental crustal areas generates the black shale, concentrates more surface uranium thorium, which stimulates the tectonics, and gradually things begin to build up. And then once the tectonics kicks in, you get a significant development of crustal thickness. Why? Because once you get the subduction taking place, what's happening is that the crustal material gets hydrated. Chemical reactions take place, especially efficiently at the subduction zones, which causes the seafloor crustal material to be hydrated and make what are called silicates. And the silicates have the property that they're much lighter than the ocean bottom basalts. And so they float above the basalts. And that goes on for a billion years or so. Eventually, you get enough silicate material piling up that it cracks the surface of the water. And instead of having a water world, you now have oceans and continents. But you're not going to have a world with oceans and continents unless you've got plate tectonics operating literally for at least a billion years. So for the first 500 million years, all we had were a few volcanic islands. We're basically looking at a water world. And to go real early, there aren't even the volcanic islands. Okay, go ahead.
Do they expect a global earthquake like the one you described in the Book of Revelation?
Well, the Book of Revelation is describing a whole bunch of earthquakes. We're not talking a single global earthquake, but rather a whole bunch of earthquakes. So, yeah, the idea that we could have an earthquake that'll split the planet into two, that makes for a good movie, but that's not going to happen. We live on a planet where the tectonics is not quite that violent. Now, what can happen, which I think would make for a better disaster movie, is you could have a tectonic event that would ignite volcanic reactions all around the Pacific Rim. And so I think that somebody's already done that kind of disaster movie where you got volcanic eruptions taking place.
Irwin Allen.
So you're next, and then I'll come back to you. Go ahead.
Well, you go back far enough when you have the supercontinents. They break up to form the other continents.
Yes.
Are you saying that life had a rule in breaking up the supercontinents?
Well, the value of a supercontinent, and we've got, I think, now traced a minimum of four supercontinents have formed in the last 2 billion years of Earth's history. I kind of give you an idea. The recent history of the Earth is a supercontinent breaking up into a bunch of smaller continents and then coming back together to make a supercontinent breaking up again. That cycle seems to happen about every 500 million years. You go from a supercontinent to a bunch of continents to, and so right now, We have seven small continents, but if we wait long enough, they will come back together to make a supercontinent. Now, when you got a supercontinent, that actually stimulates tectonics. Because what happens is you got one landmass, and all around the edge of the landmass, you've got a severe gravitational stress, which actually magnifies the tectonics, and that plays a role in breaking up the continents. Now, where life plays a role is that when you've got a supercontinent, that actually limits the amount of life you can have, because in the center of the supercontinent, you're not going to have a lot of rainfall. So it's going to be kind of a desert-like area. So when you've got a supercontinent, there's less life on the supercontinent than it would be with a bunch of small continents. However, the life around the edge of the supercontinent will actually stimulate the tectonics around that edge. And that eventually causes the supercontinent to break up. It causes light to proliferate, which generates more tectonic activity. But the stresses aren't as dramatic. When you've got a bunch of small continents, you don't get as severe a stress around the edges. Now, that's good for us today, because that means we don't get super earthquakes when you're living at the seashore, like you would when you got a supercontinent.
Are you suggesting that the primary reason is the gravitational force in the edges that caused the breakup, rather than light?
Actually, it's a combination of the two. Because when you've got a supercontinent, you're going to have all that stress there, which means you're going to have more erosion forces around the edge of the supercontinent. Life is going to contribute to that. And different life forms have different erosive rates. For example, on the planet today, we've got the maximum erosive forces due to life, mainly because the continents are filled with these vascular plants. And the vascular plants actually erode material off of the land masses anywhere from 2 to 4 times as efficiently as a non-vascular plants. I mean, hey, just go into the mountains of California, right? You're going to see coniferous trees growing right out of solid granite. Vascular plants can do that. They have this amazing capacity to suck up minerals and moisture from the interior of what looks like solid rock. And if you leave that there long enough, it actually breaks up these granite mountains. So yeah, if you go into Yosemite Park, especially go on the east side, you're going to see these granite mountains with actually trees growing all the way up through the granite. But if you go back 1 billion years or 500 million years, there were no coniferous trees. There were no vascular plants at all, and the erosion rates were much less. Now, there's actually an advantage to having higher erosion rates. What it does is it stimulates a lot of tectonic activity. But if you've got lots of small continents, the tectonic activity is going to be spread out. With the supercontinents, all going to be just around the edge. But with multiple continents, you're going to have several smaller rings of this tectonic activity. And so it distributes the tectonic activity, but it also means you're going to have a much stimulated erosion rate. And a stimulated erosion rate actually plays the role of pulling more greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere. And that actually helps cool the planet, which is a good thing, because what's happening over the past 3 billion years, the sun's been getting brighter and brighter and brighter. And so you need the combination of the tectonics and the continents covered with plant material. And gradually, the plants need to become more and more efficient in eroding material off the continents. And actually, we see that in the last 500 million years. Plants on the continents have been getting progressively more and more efficient in eroding material off of the continents into the oceans, where they get subducted underneath, pulling out greenhouse gases. I mean, to give you an idea, what do photosynthetic plants do? They take carbon dioxide and water from the surface environment and make sugars, starches, and fats. And water and carbon dioxide are greenhouse gases. So the sugars, starches, and fats get buried into the interior of the earth. That pulls out carbon dioxide. It pulls out water. And I think several months ago, I showed you in class here how we got rain falling on the continental land masses. That actually pulls greenhouse gases of the atmosphere. It generates a reaction where the silicates get chemically transformed into carbonates and sand. But the net result is carbon dioxide is pulled out of the atmosphere to transform the silicates into sand and carbonates. That's responsible for 80% of the greenhouse gas removal on the planet today, is that chemical reaction. The other 20% is the burial of plant and animal material into the interior of the Earth. And you need both working together in order to compensate for the fact that the sun's getting brighter and brighter. By the way, don't quote me as saying that that's a global warming phenomenon. The sun today is about 15 to 18% brighter than it was 3.5 billion years ago. So as we project that into the future, it's not going to significantly warm the planet over the next 100 years. Over the next 10 million years, it will. It'll be a very significant factor 10 million years from now, 30 million years from now. But it'd be a mistake to actually pull that into global warming models today, because the increase in the sun's luminosity is very, very slow. I mean, as I say, just 15 to 18% over 3.5 billion years. But I can tell you this, 30 million years from now, no matter what we do, the planet will go sterile. Why? Because you cannot pull enough greenhouse gases of the atmosphere. If you do pull enough out to compensate for the increasing brightness of the sun, you'll no longer have enough carbon dioxide in the atmosphere to sustain photosynthesis. And when photosynthesis shuts down, then, well, certainly we human beings are in trouble if there's no photosynthesis. We simply won't have food to eat. Okay, I forget who is next. You are next.
Yes, a little while back you mentioned the Kuiper Belt, and that 99% of it was eliminated during the Great...
heavy bombardment, right.
So what is the total mass left? Is it equal to the Earth? If you were to combine all the Kuiper Belt material, how much mass is there now?
Okay, at the time of the late heavy bombardment, it added up to 1% the mass of the Earth. So right now it's about 0.1%. So that's still a lot of stuff. So, and you know, we are going to continue to be bombarded, but not by as big a stuff as we were 3.5 billion years ago.
So that would be less than the mass of the moon, right? The whole Kuiper Belt.
Yes. Yeah, it'd be less than the mass of the moon. Oh, wait a minute. No, I don't think so. It's got to be...
still a little more than that?
It's got to be more than that, yes. Because we actually found some Kuiper Belt bodies that are bigger than the moon.
Oh. Okay.
So, yeah. Yes. Pardon me, here's the figure. I was wrong. It was equal to one Earth mass. It's now down to 1% of an Earth mass. Yeah. Yeah, so I was off by a factor of 100, which is pretty... in astronomy, a factor of 100 is no big deal. So, go ahead.
Does the oxygen thing obviously have anything to do with it? I was reading recently and surprised to see how much oxygen is actually in the surface of the Earth, and it's one of the more abundant elements because this plate tectonics is buried so much oxygen in the Earth. Does that play a role in the plate tectonics also, or is that just a byproduct?
Yeah, I mean, here's a trivia question. What's the most abundant element in the crust of the Earth? It's oxygen. Makes up 50% of the crust of the Earth.
Incredible, yeah.
So, and, you know, for the first few hundred million years, in fact, for the first G, it wasn't until 2.45 billion years ago that the Earth actually rose from having more than 0.001% oxygen. And that was in spite of the fact that our planet was loaded with photosynthetic life. The problem was this photosynthetic life was pumping copious amounts of oxygen in the atmosphere, but it was all being gobbled up by what are called the methanogens. And so, for example, our oceans, we now calculate, had about 25% more water 3.8 billion years ago than they do now. It was a combination of these bacteria producing methane, and that methane reacting with the oxygen that was formed by photosynthetic life, and that caused hydrogen to escape to outer space and actually reduce the oceans to what they are right now. So the oceans aren't as deep today as they were 3.5 billion years ago. But basically what's happening, all the oxygen being pumped up was being soaked up, and so the oxygen content did not rise. And what really happened at 2.45 billion years ago is there was a catastrophic collapse and the methanogens here on planet Earth, which finally allowed the oxygen level to rise. And actually, it's a kind of a synergistic relationship. What was happening is that photosynthetic life was getting more and more of a grip in the oceans and on the emerging land masses, especially the emerging land masses. As the oxygen began to rise, it eventually reached a point where it started killing off all the methanogens. And when that happened, the oxygen began to go up and the ocean stabilized. So that event took place 2.3 to 2.45 billion years ago. They call that the Great Oxygenation Event. And actually, there's several great oxygenation events. And this isn't the end of the story. You have life of different forms, what we call the Great Oxygenation Events, and the ice ages that work together to get you up to 4,300 minerals. And without those 4,300 minerals, we wouldn't be able to launch and sustain global high technology civilization. Yes.
Why isn't there an Atlantic rim of fire and an ocean rim of fire?
Well, there actually are rims of fire around the Atlantic and the Indian, just that they're nowhere near as dramatic as the one around the Pacific. So, yeah, I mean, you've got the greatest tectonic stresses around the outer edge of the Pacific Ocean. And so where we live today is where we've got significant mountain building. I mean, these mountains that you see north of us, they're going up 9 millimeters a year. That's the second fastest anywhere in the world. The only place where you got mountain building that's more aggressive is the Himalayas. That's 17 millimeters a year. So if you want mountain property, this is a place to live. Just wait long enough, and you'll be looking at something akin to the Himalayas. So it's going to happen. But it's going to be a long-term investment. Yes, in the back.
So all of these things happening, and all of these scientists are finding this out, and they still believe in evolution. I mean, it's so obviously science. How can they even look at this and think?
Well, that's a good question. And what I told you earlier is that I don't think anyone has really put this whole story together. What you see in the literature are geologists working on the geology, biology working on the biology, geophysicists working on the tectonics, but they really don't communicate with one another. And if you put it all together, you realize there's synergy going on everywhere. The physics needs the chemistry needs the life needs the physics. You've got to have it all working together, and it's all got to be step by step in sequence with the changing physics of the moon and the sun. I didn't mention this, but the moon plays a role in this because the moon is gradually moving farther and farther away from the Earth, and that's affecting the tides. And I just read a few papers this morning making the point that what happens when you've got an ice age is it creates a certain area between the bottom of the ice and the bedrock, because when you've got big glaciers, that's what's going to happen when you've got thousands of feet of ice resting upon, say, North America and Asia, is that that ice as it moves in towards the ocean is going to scour the continents right down to bedrock. And when you scour it right down to bedrock, you get an interesting layer between the bottom of the ice and the bedrock. What happens when you've got thousands of feet of ice, the temperature at the bottom of the ice is going to be a lot warmer than the top of the ice because you've got all the pressure of that ice weighing down. And it's grinding against the bedrock. So you actually get a temperature zone where the temperature is at freezing. You actually can, like, for example, they got what's called Vostok Lake in Antarctica. Antarctica, you know, well below zero, but with the thousands of feet of ice, the pressure of the ice actually raises the temperature at the bottom of the ice sufficiently that it melts the ice. And so you've got a lake underneath these thousands of feet of ice. Okay. What these papers that I brought with me here today are pointing out is that at this bedrock layer where you've got thousands of feet of ice above and the weight of ice is actually warming up the bottom of the ice to where you've got a little bit of liquid water, what it does, it creates an environment for certain microorganisms. And what those microorganisms do is they generate chemical reactions with the water and with the bedrock material to pull minerals into the environment that you'd otherwise never get. And so we now recognize that a lot of these 4,300 minerals are minerals that are generated by microorganisms and what they call the bedrock glacial ice interface, the bottom of the glacial ice and the top of the bedrock. With those microorganisms, you get chemical reactions you get nowhere else. And the other benefit of these ice ages is it's scouring these continents and basically pulling nutrients and dumping them into big valleys. And so, for example, that's what California's like. We have these giant glaciers running through Yosemite and dumping a whole lot of what we call glacial alluvial material into the San Joaquin Valley. Super rich with all the minerals produced by these microorganisms, plus all the sediment that they were bringing down, just the way they scour things down to the bedrock. There's going to be a lot of mineral-rich sediment that they bring down, and they dump it into these valleys. And guess what? Thousands of years later, we grow crops in those valleys. And the only thing about the San Joaquin Valley, the soil is so rich, you can grow anything you want, and you can have four crops a year because it doesn't get that cold here in California. But none of that would be possible if we didn't have the last ice age. And the wonderful thing about the last ice age, it made it all the way down to California. And because it made it all the way down to California, we can have 35 million people living in the state of California today, growing crops that we export to all the other states of the Union. So next time you're enjoying your broccoli, you might want to thank God for the fact that we had a really severe ice age that brought all these amazing nutrients into the valleys of California. So that we could thrive.
I like to eat broccoli, but not raw, because my teeth aren't good enough to eat raw broccoli. I eat it cooked, yes, but not raw.
Well, the truth is that you can have lots of other mineral-rich vegetables that you can eat, things like kale, broccoli. What else do they grow here in California? Artichokes, Brussels sprouts. I mean, you name it. We live in a place where you can have a really healthy lifestyle, again, thanks to the fact that we had an especially severe ice age.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing is the rapidity of the ice ages. What the ice ages do is they super enrich with nutrients these valleys. For example, I grew up in Vancouver, British Columbia. Just outside of Vancouver, we got what's called the Fraser River Valley. It's kind of like the valleys we have here in California, carved out by giant glaciers, leaving behind this nice, big, flat, nutrient-rich valley, and that's the place where people in British Columbia grow very prolific crops. Again, the soil is super nutrient-rich, and they can easily grow abundant crops there. However, if you have that kind of agriculture going on for thousands of years, eventually what happens, you leach the ground of all of its nutrients. But thank God, you wait a few tens of thousands of years, you get another ice age. What does the ice age do? It re-enriches all those valleys. And so that is able to sustain that kind of agriculture there. And so people say, well, how come we have ice ages every 100,000 years? Wouldn't it be nice if we only had them every million years? Well, if we only had them every million years, we'd wind up draining our great agricultural areas of all the nutrients we need to grow the kinds of variety of plants we need to sustain civilization. And I could show you photos, I don't have them here. The other benefit of glaciers is that they make harbors. Without harbors, it'd be difficult to trade. And so I just got back from Australia, and if you look at Tasmania, all the people live in glacier-carved harbors. Where you get this huge glacier that cuts down and makes this fjord. Well, the wonderful thing about a fjord, you can put a port city at the end of the fjord. It's not going to be subject to storms, because by the time the waves go through the fjord, they basically get tamped down, and so you can have shipping that goes out of those ports. And that's not important today. If you look at Los Angeles, I think we are now ranked as the busiest port in the world, and we're not in a fjord. But what do we do here? I mean, go down to San Pedro and Long Beach. You'll see that we've built an artificial fjord. What we've done is we kind of used stones and concrete, whatever, and built these breakers that actually protect the ships inside. Now, that would not be possible for early humans. And so early humans needed to take advantage of natural safe harbors. And those natural safe harbors were produced by glaciers. And so, for example, what you see in both Europe and Asia and here in North America, as well as parts of South America, go down to Chile, you'll see there's been lots of natural harbors, thankfully carved out by these glaciers. And so, again, lots of reasons to thank God for glaciers come Thanksgiving Day. Okay, that wraps up our study of Psalm 147 and 148. Next week, we're going to look at Proverbs 3 as we prepare to jump into Proverbs 8. Again, Proverbs 8 is one of the more significant texts in the Bible that tell you what God was doing in the 6 days of creation. And like the text you see in Psalm 104 and what you see in Job 37 through 39, it doesn't give you a time sequence. It's written in poetry. And therefore, just like we found in Psalm 104 and the 3 chapters in Job, the 6 days are not presented chronologically. It jumps back and forth all over the place. No problem. You've got a chronology to tie things together in Genesis 1. What you're getting in these poetic books is basically what I would call detailed commentary on what you're getting in Genesis chapter 1. So we're going to find in Proverbs, for example, a lot of details about the creation chronology that are not given to us in Genesis 1 or Psalm 104 or Job 37, 38, and 39. So don't expect it to be chronological. As you read through that text, don't think this happens first, this happens second. It's jumping back and forth. But because of the way it's written, it has the capacity to give us really significant details you're not going to get out of the Genesis text. Okay, with that, let me close us in prayer. And Lord, we want to thank you for this rich study we've had in Psalm 147 and 148 and all the creation psalms. Thank you, Lord, that you've loaded so much into the text of the book of Psalms on the subject of creation. We thank you, too, Lord, how you link those texts with texts on the doctrine of redemption. And Father, I pray as we continue this study through the Bible on the creation texts, we'd always recognize, Lord, that either right before or right afterwards, there's a message that links the doctrine of creation with the doctrine of redemption and salvation. So, Lord, we thank you for how that's done in Psalm 147 and 148, and we look forward to that in the book of Proverbs and Ecclesiastes as well. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
Thank you.